This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePauw. This week, we talked to saxophone professor Scotty Stepp about the upcoming saxophone studio recital. Music history professor Matthew Balanzuela tells us about music that moves him. Student producer Matt Skiba talks to students about their experiences working with guest composer Libby Larson during the Music of the 21st Century Festival. We strand senior percussion student Josiah Rushing on a desert island and answer a question on the subject of symphony. And we look forward to next week's visit by the adventurous chamber music ensemble Time for Three. There are lots of exciting things going on in the DePauw School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. On Friday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. in Thompson Recital Hall, we'll feature our saxophone studio in recital. And here to chat with us is our often visiting guest, Scotty Stepp. Welcome back.
Thanks for having
me. It's tough being a superstar here at DePauw, where you're always in the studio. We're talking about the next thing you're doing. Last week, you got to play with Libby Larson. That was a fun piece.
It was. It was just a real honor to play that with her in the audience, listening.
Yeah, it was very great. Very neat piece. So you got to hold forth because you were the preacher.
That's right. I was the preacher with a message. It was a lot of fun. It really was.
It was. Holy roller. It went over in a great way. So, now you've got your students up playing, and we've got a saxophone recital right around the corner. What's happening?
That's right. Next Friday, we'll be here in Thompson Recital Hall at 7:30 p.m. We're going to open the concert with a John Cage piece that was written for actual saxophone ensemble in 1991 for Professor John Sampin at Bowling Green State University. So John Sampin's kind of mission in life is to make sure that really important composers don't get by without
writing.
That's exactly right. So he commissioned this piece. So it involves the entire saxophone studio. So we'll open the concert with that. And it's like John Cage, there's lots of chance elements involved in the piece. And I think it's a lot of fun. You know, sometimes the students don't like it as much as I do, but I think it's an important piece, certainly for us as saxophonists, to have from John Cage.
Absolutely. John Cage is an important voice to be heard. Just finished with centenary celebration.
That's right.
So
yeah.
We got it in just under the wire.
That's right. And then the next piece that will be performed is by a saxophone trio. It features three of our sophomores, and we actually, just this past weekend, we got back from Bowling Green State University, where our North American Saxophone Alliance Regional Conference took place, and they performed on the conference. So we've got a trio by William Albright entitled Duda for three alto saxophonists, and they did a great job. It's a really challenging piece. There's lots of extended techniques, you know, for the saxophone. So it was, initially, I was a little worried because I thought, I've given them a little bit more, you know, bit off a little bit more than they can chew, but they rose to the challenge and did a fantastic job at the conference. And I think it's the first time that, you know, I've got a chance to take a group of students to one of our regional saxophone conferences, and they had a great time. It was a really wonderful experience for them.
What a great opportunity for them.
That's right. Yeah, and they learned a lot, that's for sure. And so they're going to give a repeat performance of that here on campus. So I'm looking forward to hearing them do that again. So that'll be a nice addition to the recital. Mm-hmm. The rest of the concert will be primarily saxophone quartets. Ah. We're doing a new piece. It's not new. It's new to me and my repertoire with my quartet. It's Gabriel's Oboe by Morricone. And it was actually composed for
The Mission.
The Mission, that's correct.
Right. Yeah. That's a beautiful piece.
It really is. It's originally scored for orchestra.
Yeah. Right. Ennio Morricone is as good as it gets for film scoring.
It's a beautiful piece, so looking forward to having the quartets play that as well. And I should clarify, there are two saxophone quartets performing. Mm-hmm. So then we'll have a piece called Sailor's Hornpipe by Henry Cowell. Right. And it's a very famous saxophone quartet. Lots of high school groups play it for, contests all over the... Yeah, it's a fun piece. Then the first quartet will follow it up with the Robert Burns Suite by Paul Harvey, which is another very entertaining, very Scottish, folk music-based tune. And so very listenable, and the kids have a really good time with that one. And then we're going to finish up the program with a piece by a brother duo on this. There's Faustine and Maurice Jean-Jean, and it's the Quatuor for saxophones, saxophone quartet. So it's a nice, historically standard French quartet piece.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it should be quite an entertaining concert. The kids are bugging me to do an even more entertaining version of Looney Tunes as kind of an encore for the whole studio. So I haven't decided for our listeners if we're going
to
do that or
so
not yet.
Come but to find out.
That's right. But I'm being pressured heavily. Right. So we might end up doing that for nice entertainment, at the very end of the recital.
I just tell my students, write what you'd want me to do on the back of a $100 bill and slide it under my door.
I'll remember
give that,
that
some thought. Yeah, and you guys, so you've had this opportunity to perform in the conference. You've had this opportunity to perform here in Thompson Recital Hall. And you also will be performing twice in our new venue in town, Almost Home.
That's correct. I'm really looking forward to having the kids do that out in public, you know. So we're putting together some kind of public-friendly pieces for them to listen to. So it'll be a good opportunity, you know, because in a lot of those situations, especially as people are dining, you know, the saxophone can be, well...
A rather
louder instrument than maybe people want to listen to as they're having dinner, right, you know, right beside them. So it's going to be a good opportunity for them to kind of learn to play to the venue.
Right. This is a new effort by the School of Music to be out in the public a little more. So there's a nice restaurant here in town called Almost Home, and has a little bar next to it called the Swizzle Stick, and they're connected. And so the School of Music students are going to be out playing on Wednesday nights in that venue, and two different saxophone quartets will be there on two different Wednesday evenings. So be sure to check us out at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays at Almost Home. Well, you've got another great program in store for us. People have to stop by to find out if the Looney Tunes did make it on as the encore. And it's always great to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming in to chat about it.
Thanks for having me, Dr. McCoy.
From the Producer's Vault, from the March 3rd, 2013 closing concert of DePauw's Music of the 21st Century Festival, this is saxophone professor Scotty Stepp and the DePauw University Band under the direction of Professor Craig Paré performing Libby Larson's Holy Roller. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Matt Skiba, and I am a student producer here for Music for Life. I am running a student corner with Dan Hickey, a clarinet for both the university band and the university orchestra.
Hi.
Laura Neal, the mezzo-soprano in the university chorus.
Hello.
And Jenny Miller, violin player for the university orchestra.
Hi.
For our experiences working with Libby Larson while she's here for the 21st Century Music Festival. The first thing I wanted to ask you was, how is Libby Larson's music different from the other music we normally play in the other ensembles? Laura?
From a choir standpoint, usually it's very reserved, very elegant. We try to be anyways, like stand up straight, sing the best you can, very pretty. The pieces that we're doing are called The Settling Years, and it's about pioneers in the West and basically about cowboys. So the entire time we are supposed to be not necessarily singing the prettiest sounds. We're like yipping and yoo-hawing the entire time, and it is really trying to get the character of the Old West. We actually have a dance section, which is fun, to say the least, and it's so different from what we usually do here at DePauw.
Dan, what about you?
I had a coaching with her last night for a chamber piece I'm doing of hers. She really just wants you to go overboard with everything, like bring your softs really like as low as you can, be as loud as you can, aggressive. Like, it's not necessarily that highly refined classical sound that she wants. And it was interesting. She told me that you need a highly trained classical player so that you can play like you're not one. I thought it was really interesting. And it's just a very energetic style of playing that you have to put forward.
Jenny, is there anything you'd like to add?
Similarly, in the orchestra rehearsal with her on Wednesday, she just kept saying, like, more raucous, like, more. Like, everything we did, she just wanted more and more of it and just, like, over-dramatized.
Sounds like everybody's just had a blast working with her. Besides, obviously, working with her and liking her personality, I assume, what kind of things do you like about her music? Dan?
It's just very unique. And I especially notice in both the band and the orchestra pieces, there's a great contrast between beautiful kind of melodies that she has against these amazing textures that she creates. Mm-hmm. Like, I know in the orchestra piece, Deep Summer Music has this wonderful backdrop with the horns, and it's gorgeous, and the violins come in, and it's amazing. In band, the backgrounds are very rhythmic. Like, one section will have this crazy rhythm, and then on their 16th note rest, someone else is playing. So it's a very different kind of texture, I guess, and it's really cool.
Laura?
She does an amazing job of painting a picture, especially with all her vocal works as well. The text is there to tell the story, and you can hear what the character, who whatever singer is portraying that character, what they're saying, what they're feeling. But in the piano accompaniment or any other accompaniment, you can hear the picture of what's going on. And through the rhythm and through her melody, you can hear what's going on around the speaker, which I think is fantastic.
Being music majors and everything, we're very used to practicing and going to a practice room, sitting down with the music, whether it be our solos or our repertoire for our ensemble pieces. Is there anything different practicing Libby Larson's music? Jenny?
I thought it was different because individually, each part just by itself, it doesn't seem part of anything. And it's really hard to like get the feel of the piece until you hear like how it fits in with the rest of the setting. Like with the Bach 358 and orchestra, it's just a bunch of different interjections. And it's really hard to get the feel of how it sounds in your head until after you've put it together with everything. And then it sounds complete and it's easier to practice.
Dan?
My biggest thing is lots and lots and lots of metronome work. Her piece, Corker, for clarinet and percussion is very, very notey. It's a lot of fun, but I've been working on it for over a year. It's taken a while.
Wow. Laura?
I think it's just a difference in style and, I guess, technique, especially with her vocal music and all our choir music, especially ones that we've been working on. It's not necessarily classical style singing all the way, depending on the piece, really, just because you're making a different kind of sound to create the picture she wants for her music, which I think is very interesting.
So what was your favorite part of Libby Larson's visit?
It would definitely be her chamber coachings. She's just so full of energy, and she knows her pieces so well, and she knows the sound that she wants, and she gets very nitpicky, but she's never like mean about it. She's a great person to work with, and I really enjoyed working with her and learned a lot from it.
Jenny?
Yeah, I really enjoyed working with her during the orchestra rehearsal, and just seeing her face like light up when she would see us do something well in her music is an awesome feeling. And it was just really neat to see her in action. she was actually like listening to our ideas about her music too and composing stuff on the spot with us. And it wasn't like everything has to be like perfectly how I composed it. She was listening to our suggestions and including like that and actually changing some of it on the spot.
Laura?
My favorite part of the past 5 days has definitely been actually recital hour, just hearing her interview with Professor Perkins, just because you get to see what she's like as a person, like her views, almost her worldview on different topics, which I thought was extremely interesting. And she's clearly a very interesting woman as well as composer.
Awesome. So we'd like to thank all three of you for coming in and congratulations on a great week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
From the very beginning of Music for Life, we've been shipping first School of Music professors and then some College of Liberal Arts professors off onto a desert island with a defective iPod. Now that we've sent all the professors off, we've decided to start sending away some students. And the first student that we're shipping off to the desert island is Josiah Rushing, senior percussion major here at DePaul. Welcome, Josiah.
Thank you.
So we're banishing you. You're stuck out on a desert island. Your iPod's defective. It can only play 5 minutes, and you're going to hear this 5 minutes over and over again. What's on it?
I would actually probably choose something by Philip Glass, as I really love his music, and I've been attracted to his music since middle school, actually.
Really? Since
yes.
middle school?
Yeah.
What got you into Philip Glass?
It was my seventh grade year in middle school, and it was ancient history class. And my teacher then would do these skits to show the rituals of various ancient cultures like mm-hmm. Romans. And so he would use the film score from Kundun, the mm-hmm. movie Kundun, which mm-hmm. has Philip Glass as the composer. Mm-hmm. So I've loved his music ever since then. And I really never knew who he was until I came to DePaul and started learning more about him mm-hmm. in 20th century. And
minimalism.
Minimalism.
So Philip Glass is known for his minimalist music. And is there a particular piece of his you would go for?
Probably one of his operas. Last semester in France, I was able to see his Les Enfants Terribles. And I really enjoyed that. So maybe that, since it has some emotional value to me.
And now you got to drill down to 5 minutes of it.
Yes.
So where would you pick?
Probably near the end, because it gets very emotional and there's themes from all throughout the opera that come up, and I really enjoy that.
So here you are, you're off on your desert island, and maybe we'll come get you or at least send you a new iPod. Thanks for coming
in. Okay, thank you very much.
Life's tragedies never play the way we imagined them. Their simplicity, grandeur, and bizarre detail lie beyond our understanding.
Qui a de la chance, un dimanche, j'avais peur qu'on ouvre pas, j'ai encore une clé. Et Paul, Paul, je sais pas, si de comme d'habitude. Mais qu'est-ce que tu as? Il m'a écrit qu'il s'empoisonnerait, qu'il s'éloignait de sa chambre, que j'arriverai trop tard. Il a voulu te faire une farce, drôle de farce.
Parle-moi,
parle-moi.
Boire.
Ne me fais pas peur. Parle, explique.
kavut agat. Kavut, kavut.
We have a segment from time to time. It's called The Question You Never Ask, to demystify classical music in some way. And this year we've had the question submitted to us, and because it's crunch time as we are in the midterm for students, we've invited our producer, Matthew Champagne, to come in and chat about The Question Never Asked. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Dean McCoy.
Good to have you on this side of the window.
It's good to be here.
So, what is our question this week?
Well, Adam came up with a really interesting question that had to do with symphony.
The word.
The word, and when we started chatting about it in the production meeting, it seemed to kind of bloom into a number of things. The original question had to do with why are symphonies referred to by their key?
Ah.
And also, why do they have multiple movements?
Hmm. So the symphony has evolved over a period of many years, the father of the symphony being Joseph Haydn.
Sure.
Although.
now there was, Sammartini.
Yes, right.
Was an early symphonist.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found most intriguing about the question was, and this might be getting too deep into it, but coming from the Baroque era and into the classical, when composers were faced with the necessity or the desire to organize larger and larger segments of time.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the massive work of the Baroque, maybe the fugue,
mm-hmm.
you could just go so far with the fugue
right.
before it stopped making any sense.
Right. So, you know, one of the standard questions, trick questions on music appreciation tests, how many symphonies did Bach write? You know, Bach didn't write any because
right.
he was busy writing dance suites, which was another way that we collected larger forms. We made one piece out of many forms.
Sure.
And that dance suite then evolved over time into Haydn's and Sammartini's and others of that era.
Right. And an important stepping stone was the development of sonata from binary form.
Right.
Which allowed composers to stretch out, have much larger...
Yeah, we needed a structure. So if a composer just sits down and lets his pen run on, or her pen run on, we need some kind of structure. There needs to be some kind of organized repetition. And sonata allegro form, in which there was an exposition, then that expository material was developed, and then we repeated that exposition, was something that people could comprehend on a single hearing. And although, interestingly, something we don't do today, it wasn't uncommon in those days to repeat a particularly favorite movement right after the symphony or right after it was performed as people liked it. So the idea is that that sense of form and repetition made it accessible to people on a single hearing. Remember, in those days, they couldn't listen to it over and again on a CD.
That's right.
Recording.
We didn't. That's so hard to imagine.
Isn't that true? And imagine if every symphony that you heard, you'd never heard before and couldn't hear again. You know, that, and that's the way it was for listeners in that day.
Unless you bought the music, like a piano reduction, mm-hmm. like Liszt.
Which was often very famous, the piano reduction, so that you could play these symphonies
at home.
At home, which was really unusual. So it's a very fascinating idea. The symphony evolved over time, and it got bigger and bigger. So you think that the introduction to a Beethoven symphony could have been as long as a movement, mm-hmm. and a complete movement of an early symphony. And then Mahler and Bruckner and where they took it, almost to the point that it could go
almost
further.
To the breaking point.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So symphony kind of took the role of a concert dance suite.
And the sonatas that were being played in churches and mm-hmm. different ways that things were being organized, there's a lot, I think, that brought it together. The interesting, you know, Mahler said that a symphony should be the whole world. You're trying to find a box to hold these huge thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the waltz of the dance suite or of the dance became the waltz movement of
right.
a symphony.
Minuet, trio,
the minuet
scherzo.
And trio, which then Beethoven sped up uh-huh. and made to the point that you couldn't dance to it. It became kind of a joke in that way, uh-huh. hence the word scherzo, which yeah. means joke. It's fascinating how you can trace this through. You could do a course on just the symphony
oh, yeah.
and trace it and spend semesters after semester on that issue.
Now, what about keys? Changing keys, knowing a symphony by its key and the key relationships within a symphony.
That's something I don't think that we understand today in the same way that they understood then, because now we're much more passive listeners.
And, well, with the tuning standard the way it is, with equal temperament,
right.
a lot of keys just kind of sound the same, whereas in earlier tuning systems, various keys, the
had
farther
characters.
Away from tonic,
right.
the less in tune it would be, and it would have its own character.
So this is evolved from the question you never asked to 4,000 questions we've asked but not answered, which is kind of fun. But the truth is that the advent of equal temperament did change things in that it made the keys, whether you played in the key of A or the key of F, they sound much more similar than they did in the initial days of the symphony. And that key structure also made the forms possible. So, for example, in sonata allegro form, and we're getting down in the weeds here, but in sonata allegro form, in the exposition, the first two themes are in different keys, but when they come back in the recap, they're in the same key, and that was a sense of coming home and mm-hmm. rounding out and answering our questions, much better than we're doing on the question you never asked, but they answered our questions, and the key structure was very important at that time.
And key changes between movements could mm-hmm. have another...
Also take you there and back
mm-hmm.
again.
Yeah.
So our suggestion is just start listening to Sammartini or Haydn, then pick up a little Mozart and see the pinnacle of that, and then see what Beethoven did to it and how he moved it on, and then how lush it became under the pen of Tchaikovsky and folks of his ilk, and then see how Mahler and Bruckner took it to the point that it couldn't hold anything else, and now we're in a world where there are lots of great symphonies out there that fit in the varying guises that we've presented over that period of time.
I think that's a fine answer.
Right, exactly. So we've moved from the question you never asked to the question you barely answered. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. From the producer's vault, this is a recording from the March 3rd, 2013 closing concert of DePauw's Music of the 21st Century Festival. Of the DePauw University Orchestra, under the direction of Professor Orsineth Smith, performing Libby Larson's Bach 358.
Hello, my name is Matthew Balanzuela. I teach music history at DePauw University, and Dufayi's setting of Ave Regina Caelorum is music that moves me. Like many pieces in the Middle Ages, Dufayi originally began with a piece of chant, setting the text, Hail Queen of Heaven, Hail Mistress of the Angels, or in Latin, Ave Regina Caelorum. What we're hearing now is the original chant, which Dufayi probably sang as a boy when he was a chorister in Cambrai. It's a short devotional text to Mary, probably used in services such as the office. Dufayi is one of the most famous composers of the 15th century. I first got to know his music when I took music history as an undergraduate myself. I wasn't really interested in taking music history. I wasn't looking forward to the class, and the beginning of it was pretty boring because of music like the chant. I wasn't very interested in that as a performance major at a big conservatory. But when I got to the music of Dufayi, I became very, very interested in the music. In a bit, we'll play the Dufayi setting. You'll hear the chant melody in the top voice. So Dufayi is basing his composition on the chant itself, and he wanted listeners to recognize that. Around it, supporting it in various ways, are the other four voices, and Dufayi is about to usher music into a very modern world. You'll hear pairs of duets, you'll hear trios, you'll hear Dufayi using the choir almost like an orchestra with shadings of groupings and textures. Most importantly to me, as you listen, is how Dufayi will often change the feeling or the mood. Music of this time is just beginning to discover triads, what we know as major chords and minor chords. As I said before, you'll hear the chant in the top voice. The work will begin not with all four voices, but with a light duet. And as you listen to the music unfold, I particularly am always caught by the beauty of Dufayi's phrases that arch and undulate. It's almost like looking at the ocean, but hearing it in sound. The phrases rise and fall, they speed up, they rush to the conclusion, almost like the waves coming onto the beach. And now Dufayi changes the duet pair to give you another sonic space, but not yet the full chorus. When the full chorus does come in, they will supplicate or pray to Mary for mercy upon Dufayi and change to minor. The minor inflection only lasts a little bit just for the word miserere. And then as it goes on, it refers to its more major feel. The work is noticeable also historically because Dufayi's name is only five letters long. D-U-F-A-Y. And many people pronounce his name Dufay, but in the manuscript, we can clearly see that Dufayi wanted three separate syllables, so the text underlay of the piece allows us to understand how he pronounced his own name. We return now to a duet, but very quickly we'll have another pair singing the same music. And that fills in the four-voice texture. The chant melody is now firmly in the tenor, and it will be held in the tenor for most of the piece, which is a very medieval way of continuing and using pre-composed material. Thing I find very interesting about the way Dufayi shapes this piece is these large cadences and then these new sections like we have here. It's almost as if he is thinking about separate sections like later composers will think about movements of a sonata to contrast in tempo, to contrast in meter, contrast in meaning. It's almost as if he's thinking about music in a much more futuristic way. We're again here now at the Supplication to Mary, and he has changed from a texture of counterpoint where every voice is doing the same thing to a very vertical structure, almost like chords. And again, this is very future-looking toward a more triadic sound that we'll have more like in the later Renaissance or the Baroque. And right there was his name, Dufayi, very quietly. I think the question that comes to many people's mind is, why does the music move me? Why of all the music I teach and all the music I've listened to, I constantly come back to Dufayi, his music and this piece in particular? Part of what I find so amazing about the music every time is it seems at once to be rooted in its time, a work based in the 15th century, in the counterpoint, in the traditions of the church, and yet at the same time it seems timeless. It seems as if Dufayi is seeing ahead to a world where text expression, saying what the word means and drawing that in the music, makes sense, in which orchestration is going to be an important part, where you're changing the combination of voices. in which musical expression through the phrase, through cadence, all have a major role to play. It seems to me both rooted in its time and both transcendent of it. My thought upon listening to this music when I was in college was, how did Dufayi know where to put the next note? How, as the phrases evolve, does he know when to speed up? When does the phrase peak? When does he come down to the cadence? When does he extend the cadence? When does he go, as he's here right now, in a long melisma, and when does he present things syllabically? From my senior year history survey, my entire career changed. I set out as a music historian at graduate school to try to know the theory that Dufayi did. It took me a century earlier into the 14th century, into study of 14th century counterpoint, into 14th century notation, into 14th century chants. But the more I know, it still is a fantastic mystery. Dufayi knew the chants, he had sung them as a boy, he knew the note values, he knew very simple rudiments of counterpoint. But I guess this is perhaps where genius lies. He is able to synthesize a music that is transcending the rules. This music obeys the rules that he knows of counterpoint that's presented in the theorists, but yet seems to speak to our time. This is why Guillaume Dufayi's Ave Regina Coelorum moves me.
Just tomorrow night, one day from now, Time for Three takes DePauw. Time for Three is the world's first classically trained garage band. It's Zach DePue on violin, Nick Kendall on violin, and bassist Renan Meyer. These are three guys that met at Curtis as grad students, and they perform a wide variety of music. They cover the Beatles and Kanye West and Justin Timberlake, and they've been invited to perform at Carnegie Hall and European festivals. They play in jazz clubs, their NFL games. They've performed for the Indy 500. These guys are all over the place. And they got started, actually, in a really interesting way. There was a blackout in Philadelphia's Mann Center for the Performing Arts during a concert. And while it was pitch black because there was no electricity, these three guys got up and started performing to cover the space in the dark. And as they say, the rest was history. These guys have taken off since that time. And they perform an incredible spectrum of music. In fact, one of their videos that you can Google on YouTube is called Stronger, and it's really about bullying. I think a lot of musicians have felt this as they've grown up and gone through middle school and high school, that you feel a little bit like you're on the outside. So their effort with that video, Stronger, was an effort to address that issue and bullying. They play bluegrass music. They play show tunes. They play rock and roll. They play Brahms. They play classical trios. They commission works. They commissioned a work from Jennifer Higdon. They're always looking for new music. And Simon Rattle, the great conductor, refers to these guys as monsters of technique. I think that's very fitting, because whether they're playing bluegrass or they're playing Brahms or whether they're playing Kanye West or they're covering the Beatles, these guys are monsters of technique. They have this ability to light up a concert hall, to light up a campus. They're great favorites on the college circuit, and we are thrilled to welcome them as the next performers in our guest artist series. They will be here Monday night in Kresge Auditorium at 7:30. This is a concert you won't want to miss.
From the Producer's Vault, this is Senior Percussion Major Josiah Rushing at the Student Recital Hour from February 13th, 2013, performing Eric Samut's Chameleon.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. Our student producers are Adam Luman, Anna Gatdula, and Matthew Skiba. Our online editor is Veronica Pedrell, and our show is produced and recorded by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thanks for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week.
It's Music for Life.